Trib Live Radio presents Off-Road Politics from Main Street to the Beltway with Selena Zito, reporter at the Pittsburgh Trib. Trib Total Media, see what's next. Now, here's your host, Selena Zito.
Hi, welcome back to Off-Road Politics. I'm Selena Zito, reporter and columnist and host of the podcast at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And on the line with me today, I'm so excited, is Matthew Dowd. Matthew is a special correspondent and analyst for ABC News, and you can find him all the time on This Week, Good Morning America, Nightline, and you write columns for various publications. I see your brilliance everywhere. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure and great to talk to you again, Selena.
Well, the first time, I'm going to make Matthew laugh right now because I didn't tell you I was going to bring this up. But the first time that we met, we were waiting for a plane in, I can't remember if it's Iowa or New Hampshire. Something tells me it
was New Hampshire.
Was it New Hampshire? Yeah.
I thought it was New Hampshire.
Yeah. And we were waiting for a plane and it had, I think, did it partially board or did we board? I can't remember if we boarded and then got off. Did we?
I think it partially boarded.
It partially boarded. Yeah. I never got on the plane, but all of a sudden we're people start coming back off and the plane is delayed. And, you know, they said for mechanical difficulties and, you know, you think that, oh my God, it's something terrible. And do I really want to go on this plane? Blah, blah, blah. But, you know, being the nosy person that I am, I went and bugged them until they told me what it was. And it was that someone, when they were putting their luggage in the overhead, they broke a light bulb. And
yep,
do you remember that
well?
And yes. No one was allowed to fix the light bulb except for the union guy. So we had to wait there for 1 hour and a half for the union guy to come and screw in a light bulb. And
that definitely would make a joke about how many you're consuming light bulb. It definitely was. I agree with you.
One of the pitfalls of covering national politics is that we have to get on airplanes a lot. And I don't know about you, but at some point in 2012, I just was so tired of being delayed, redirected, sleeping in airports, that I decided for the rest of the race, I was going to drive to wherever I had to go. And I did. I put 22,000 miles on my car, but I was not getting on another airplane. So,
well, that's easier from you coming from Pennsylvania than it would be from me coming from Austin, Texas.
Well, so. That is true. Pennsylvania actually has a great advantage, especially when it comes to presidential elections, because, you know, the center of the universe is Pennsylvania and Ohio.
It's center of some universes.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're looking universes. To see who's going to win, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio, I would argue that Pennsylvania always sort of lets the Republicans down, but, Ohio, you never know which way you go. It'll go. You know, Matthew, you have had an incredible career, and you have worked on both sides of the aisle. And you consider yourself an independent. And one of the things I love about listening to you, whether you are on Twitter, on Facebook, or whether you are on the Sunday morning show, your outlook on American politics and people and American politicians is always pretty balanced. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, why you think you have that point of view?
Well, thank you, and I'm a big fan of yours, so we'll have a mutual admiration talk today. So big fan of yours and your objective perspective on many different things, so appreciate that from you. I think it's a, I don't know if there's a moment or if it's a long journey just in my life, having grown up in Detroit with 10 brothers and sisters, and an Irish Catholic family.
You learn about diplomacy really well then, don't you?
Well, yeah, it's when you have 11, then you obviously have to build coalitions.
Right.
Build coalitions in a way that you can get to a majority that sort of you can get stuff done, especially when your parents aren't around. So, yeah, it's a practice. But I started in my parents were I'm probably more Republican. I became more Democratic when I went to college, which was in Missouri, and then worked for Dick Gephardt there in Missouri in my senior year, and worked along the way. And my interest was always in I was much more attracted to the person than the sort of elements of any given party. On either side I've worked on, I haven't agreed with everything. I thought there was great aspects about the Democratic Party and great aspects about the Republican Party, and also great problems with both. And so that's been a journey where I tried one, and then I obviously met then-Governor Bush and thought he had a lot of hope that he would do things differently, which obviously didn't turn out that way. And I've, like many of us, in both journalism or even in politics, I've always been attracted to the search and sort of the search for the truth, or
right.
The search for what's really going on or what you can really do to make a difference. And I think that journey doesn't really have stopping points. It's always a long path. And every time you think you've reached the truth, then there's more to discover and more to learn. And what I've learned is that you have to be willing to sort of look at both sides, not without principles. A lot of people think that, well, if you're an independent or you're without principles, it's actually, I've discovered, it's much harder to hold that ground than it is to sort stay in your tribe and judge everything from what jersey you have on, whether it's the Democratic side or the Republican.
Absolutely.
And everything seems to these days in politics seems to be, if no matter what you say or do, it's automatically thrown in this cauldron of this fight between, as I call it, dueling monopolies, actually, these dueling monopolies that exist. When the country is actually in the middle just trying to figure it out and
right.
have their families, raising their families. And so what I try to bring, I'm willing to throw flags on both sides of it, and I'm willing to say this, when President Obama does a good thing, he did a good thing. When he doesn't, he doesn't. Or when the Republicans do, and unfortunately, you've seen it over the last year in a really direct way. We think everything's calm and everything's okay, and then all of a sudden something happens, and it's like almost like dry ice dropped in a bucket of water, right? You think it's all fine, and you drop the dry ice in the bucket, and then all of a sudden it just bubbles over. And I think that's happened with Ferguson. It happened with the Confederate flag in South Carolina. It happened in Baltimore. And now it's recently happened, unfortunately, in the events surrounding tragic killings in Paris. And it's really, and it's both sides line up, don't represent the majority of the country. And it's very hard to try to bring a thoughtful, measured sort of analysis or even policy approach to that, because everybody wants to say, if you're not on their team, then you're bad or you don't love America. Or you're not compassionate, or whatever the thing happens to be. So, as you say, I try to hold that ground. It's tough. Because everybody wants to tear at you.
Right.
But I think it's the only way, obviously, to get to the what really is the truth or what really is going to be meaningful.
Right. Absolutely. I've been really thinking about this a lot, what you just spoke about, the red shirt, the blue shirt, everyone just goes to their side and you can't have a meaningful discussion. And I'm going to blame the president, but not in like a mean way, not like, oh, it's this or that. I think it's the way that, and I looked back this morning and last night, and I was sort of reflecting on all the things that he has done over the years whenever there was a crisis. He tends to, when he's ever backed into a corner, say on his policy with ISIS, and because he feels as though he was backed into a corner, he gives that speech, which pretty much everyone has said was pretty bad. And he throws the argument back to Washington, back to the Capitol. And then that in turn makes all the sides come out, all the sort of, all of a sudden everything that we do becomes very political. And I think that is at the sort of root cause right now why everyone is sort of angry about the Syrian refugees. I I honestly believe, and I've talked to a lot of people. I drove around and talked to people. I called people. I reached out to them through social media. The majority of people are very compassionate and very concerned and are heartbroken when they look up these photos of these families, you know, just, you know, making these epic journeys over land, over water, and whose homes and lives have been destroyed. A lot of people, you know, project themselves in that scenario and they think, oh my God, if that were me, I'd want someone to be there for me. And I don't think most people think most Syrian refugees are terrorists. I think what after interviews, but they think someone might be. And while they don't want the process halted completely, most people think there should be a pause. And I think that part of that is a lack of trust with government right now because they don't think it's been doing their job, right? If you look at take a look at the Secret Service. And how they have failed at things. And they think, well, Jiminy Crickets, if they can't take care of the Secret Service, how are they going to be doing the screening effectively?
Well, I think so. I think you're exactly right. And I assume that anybody involved, the president, Republicans, their intention is good, right? They have a good intention that they want to do good and they want to do what's right. So I assume that. Now, they may have a misguided policy, they may have that, and we should argue over whether it's misguided, but we shouldn't argue for our leaders. I don't think it helps to argue over intention.
Right.
But I can give you my own personal thing of that. I've got tremendous compassion, obviously, for the refugees and what they faced and their, you know, the war-torn country and what's gone on and what Assad has done and what ISIS or ISIL or ICE or
whatever their name is this week,
whatever they're calling them, which is a whole nother conversation, which is I don't know how we can declare war on something we don't even know what the name of it is
yet,
but that's a whole nother conversation. Is I put out a tweet right in the aftermath of Paris or right within a day of Paris, and I thought, okay, I basically said, I don't, you know, it's like as a country, we can be both, I can't understand why we can't be simultaneously compassionate, but also assured.
Right.
That what were the policies we're doing, we're not going to encourage or allow terrorists to come in the country. Why can't we do both? Why can't we both be idealistic,
right,
drive their compassion, and realistic and understand that they have us for harm? I thought, wow, the amount of pushback I got both from the left and the right on that one tweet,
yeah,
right? That one tweet was the left was, I can't believe you call yourself a Christian. You know, this like you can't even like ask questions. You're just supposed to accept it in and like this. And then from the right is I can't believe you're just not saying shut the borders and blah, blah, blah. And that's the awful spot that we get in. And I think that when the president does what he does on when he did his conversation that he had, I guess, from Turkey. And one of the things that I've learned about leadership in the country is that people want leaders that understand their fears, and then call them to something, a higher hope, right?
Right.
But if you can't just skip directly to the higher hope without people getting a sense you understand their fears or acknowledge their fears or don't dismiss their fears as not realistic or whatever. And I think that's the problem is that, you know, on one side, one side seems to be, all they do is seem to be appealing to people's fears to try to gain an advantage.
Right.
And the other side, all it seems to be is not even acknowledging your fears and not even acknowledge what a majority of the country feels like and straight go, like, we have made these policy decisions, it's the right thing. And that's the problem. And
yeah.
I think that, I mean, and the other thing about President Obama, and I faulted my former boss, President Bush, on this, is they seem incredibly incapable of admitting they screwed up.
Yes.
They are making a mistake. And it's funny thing about the American public is, the American public is totally willing to let you say that you made a mistake, you screwed up. They actually want you to learn and say, I messed up. President Obama seems so stuck on a path that he made a decision on that if he just stood up and said, listen, you know, we underestimated ISIS. You know, we've set up a series of policies that were reflected in that underestimation. We know we're going to have to change. We're going to do that. We're dealing with a different animal that we thought, you know, and we're going to move forward with different things. If he had done that, the country would have been like, okay, got it, that's good.
So much
different.
Know,
some people would have faulted him. But they won't. President Bush it was incapable of admitting mistakes, and why it took him so long to change course in Iraq. And President Obama seems equally incapable of admitting a mistake.
I wonder if it's a president thing. I can't remember. Well, I think it's kind of a president thing.
Part of it is a human nature thing, which is we think that we somehow think that if we admit a mistake, it's a sign of weakness, and we don't want to be weak, right?
Right.
I think that's a false read on human beings. But I also think there's a lot of advisors around in this environment that say, don't ever admit a mistake, don't ever admit a mistake, don't ever admit a mistake. You know, the other side hates you, don't ever admit a mistake. And that's a huge part of the problem. I mean, I watched that happen with President Bush. A lot of people were like, you can't admit a mistake, you can't admit a mistake. And I was always like, admit the mistake and move on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I always admire a leader, whoever it is, that they are at least willing to have a no man in the room. That's an important part of being a leader. Even if the no man doesn't get a voice or it doesn't get their way, at least you know that there was a no man in the office. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the presidential primary race on the Republican side. If you follow me on Twitter or Facebook or on this podcast, I have firmly with sort of all the risks that come with this of being wrong, I have firmly said that neither Donald Trump nor Ben Carson are ever going to win a primary state, at least in the beginning, if ever. We have, in our history, only ever elected four outsiders to the presidency, outright outsiders. There's been a couple vice presidents that have ascended, but an outright election, and that was Zachary Taylor, who was the hero of the American-Mexican War, Ulysses S. Grant, who was considered an aggressive and magnanimous general after the Civil War, Dwight D. Eisenhower, obviously World War II, big hero, looked at as a national treasure, and Herbert Hoover, all four of these men never held office, never were elected to anything, not even like school or class president. And they came in as outsiders. If you look at all of their presidencies, none of them were great outside of Dwight Eisenhower. But all of them came during a time of prosperity and peace. Two things that at least the American public believes that we are not in the middle of. So, having said that, while history doesn't always repeat itself, we do tend to repeat patterns in history. And while we are in the middle of populism as well, we also have never elected a populist president ever in our history. And again, history might not always repeat itself, but, you know, our American politics has a way of doing that. And so looking at that, looking at these men, looking at their qualifications, looking at if you look at the crosstabs of the voters that are supporting them, I do not believe that either of them find their way forward.
Well, I don't mean to go into history lesson, then I'll come to a point of this, is that, for the vast majority of the country, the nominees of the major parties were not picked by voters, right?
Right.
They were picked by a small group of people in the course of the time, and it was changed along the way. It used to be picked by members of Congress, and then with Andrew Jackson, it was then picked by conventions of local party leaders.
Right.
And then in 1912, we then had started having primaries, but only a few. And then in 1968, 1972, that whole primary process. Dwight D. Eisenhower was not picked by voters. Dwight D. Eisenhower actually lost, interesting point of fact, Dwight D. Eisenhower lost more primaries than he won in 1952 to his opponent.
Right.
Who I forget who it was. And so we are in our history, we are in a situation today where the insider establishment who sort of always has picked the president is less powerful than they've ever been.
Right.
Much less powerful. And so the outside interest, and we'll call it sort of the populist interest, especially in the Republican side, is much more in control of the of the levers of who's going to win the nomination than it's ever been in the course of this. And I know you've written about the voters out there and how they feel and what they're right. looking for. I believe, and you know, you never know what's going to happen because you never know the circumstances. I think it's very difficult for somebody like Donald Trump or Ben Carson to win the general election. I think with their how they're perceived or how they will ultimately pursue, it's going to be very hard. But you know, I never say never because
that's
the circumstances
true.
of an election. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know how it's going to unfold. And so, do I think it's possible that there's possibilities? Yeah, but the probabilities. I think actually, though, that Donald Trump or Ben Carson, but probably more Donald Trump, could win some of the GOP primaries or caucuses along the way, because, especially among the Republicans right now, there's this incredible anger, frustration at the establishment, at the party. And that there are much more, that is, that emotion is much more in control of the process than any other element is in control of the process. And an incredibly divided field without a really acceptable establishment candidate at the moment, right now, or establishment sort of experienced candidate. And Jeb Bush is not acceptable to the vast majority of the Republican Party, which is problematic, obviously, for him, which has shown why he's not risen in the support. I think there is a possibility still that Donald Trump could be the GOP nominee. I think it's possible that he could be the nominee. And I've said that since August and I know you've talked to voters and I've talked to voters, there's an unbelievable stickiness to Donald Trump's voters. That doesn't matter what he says, what he does. There's 30% of the vote that seems right now stuck on him. Now, can it shake loose? Yeah, it could shake loose. But it's not stuck on him because of policy reasons other than immigration. Immigration is the only thing that binds Donald Trump's voters together. It's more stuck on him because of a value proposition, which is this idea they're looking for strength. In an unsettled, uncertain world where we seem to be the victim of circumstances, where we still don't seem to be in charge, where they don't feel like we're a superpower anymore, they don't feel like we can exert our leadership and influence in the world. The world is controlling us and we're not in control of the events of the world. That then people go search for strength. And sometimes they settle on strength that is exhibited in a bombastic bravado way, absent another place to fall where that strength is. But I think that's been Jeb Bush's problem throughout this thing, is that the voters may agree with him on a number of issues, and they just don't perceive strength there.
Right.
And the voters will choose a strong, inexperienced, slightly unqualified candidate over a weak, qualified, experienced candidate in this election every time. And I think we still have some unfolding to do in the course of this race. And I actually think the race today is down to four possibilities: Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio. Fundamentally, I think that's where this race is settling. In that mix, the most obvious general election candidate that would be the most electable and simultaneously conservative is Marco Rubio, the most electable in a general election. But I think much is still to be sorted out in this thing. I think the power of the press is even stronger in this election than it's ever been. The advertising, I wrote a thing today for ABC News on advertising, how little effective advertising in presidential races is. Jeb Bush, want to give people one fact, Jeb Bush has outspent every other candidate in New Hampshire and Iowa by a factor of 3 and 4 to 1. He's outspent them. Jeb Bush has not moved from 7 or 8% in either of those states in
that's
the
a
last
really,
3 months.
That is a really important point. These advertisements, these commercials are just not, no matter how much he's saturating the regions with, they're just not moving the needle.
Well, and it's good, and Celine, it's good and bad news. I mean, obviously the bad news is it's a complete waste of money, and why candidates keep doing something that's a total waste of money, you know, I could argue is two reasons. They're stuck in an old way, and they're being driven by consultants that have an interest in it, a financial interest in it. But the good news is communication is more democratized today than it's been in 100 years. It's more democratized today because the barriers to communications are much lower than they were in the 80s and 90s, where in order to get heard, in order to get exposed, you had to spend hundreds and thousands of millions of dollars to get exposed. Today, on a keystroke on your computer at your desk or on your couch at home, you can talk to thousands of voters without ever spending any money.
Right.
That hasn't existed in our public, in our country, ever really. That capacity to do that. So the barriers for communications are much lower. And the other thing that adds to it is that there's, as you know, and you've written about this, is the credibility of advertising, because it doesn't come across as authentic and genuine, is so low. People are searching for something that's real, which is why, it's crazy to say it, why reality shows became so popular.
Right.
It was real, and it wasn't laugh-tracked, you know, mm-hmm. in-studio audience things. And I think that's where we are, and I think how this unfolds, I'm both concerned about and excited about, because I'm concerned about our country and what kind of leader may emerge, but I'm also excited because we're in a great time of disruption when people with an entrepreneurial spirit or entrepreneurial ideas and how they want to, you know, utilize politics or government, it's wide open to them.
Right.
And that's exciting. It's an exciting time. Though, as I say, it's a concerning time because you have no idea the type of leader that may emerge.
Well, that's absolutely true. We're talking with Matthew Dowd. He's special correspondent and analyst for ABC News. You can find him on various news and political programs. You also write for ABC News, right? You can find it online?
Yeah, I write a column. I write a column two or three times a month for ABC News.
You can also follow Matt on Twitter, which I highly recommend. It's at Matthew J. Dowd. That's MattheWJDowd. We're talking about, well, just about everything that's happened this week, from the aftermath of the attacks in Beirut and Paris, and how the political response has sort of disrupted people's way of looking at all kinds of things. And, you know, I gotta give you a plug for your book, even though you wrote it in, was it 2004?
Six.
Applebee's America.
Along with a mutual friend of ours, Ron Fournier.
Mr. Fournier.
Doug Sosnick. So, yeah. So
that was my son's favorite book when he was in college. I mean, in high school. What am I talking about? When he was in high school, he came home and was like, "Hey, that's you, Mom. That's what you do." It was a great book. I really, really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
So what are your thoughts going forward? How do you think this debate is going to play out with the Syrian refugees, and more importantly, with how we address the threat of ISIS? And then I know you have to go, and I'll let you go.
So I think the refugee thing, I think we're in a pause moment, because I think the heat has been way turned up, and I think the ability to sort of make reasoned decisions is greatly diminished. So I think we need to get through this moment. I don't think, you know, I think that until there's time and the administration sort of really shows that there's a process in place, and I know they've gone through and have it, but they have to, it's more than just intellectually convincing people that
right.
this process works. They have to sort of convince them in their gut that a process works. And part of the problem, as you pointed out, not only with the Secret Service, but, you know, with the healthcare website,
yeah.
the disaster, you know, with TSA, people's experience, one, with TSA and what goes on, when every study has been shown that 90% of the time that it fails whenever they've tried to put something through, all of that, and then for all of a sudden people that say, trust us, we're going to make this work
right.
for refugees. Until we get through this moment, I think ultimately, as it passes and the heat's turned down, I think that reasonable minds will prevail, and that will allow some sort of figuring out how to deal with the refugees. But I think in this moment right now, there's no possibility of having a reasoned argument in the midst of this moment from either side to do this. And so I think it's best to just let the flames die down a little bit and then address it outside the aftermath of this. I don't, as I said, on ISIS or in this thing we're dealing with on terrorism, I think two things about this. First of all, it would be great if the Republican side could say, oh, by the way, Much of this was created through a bad decision that was made on the war in Iraq. Much of this was created because of that and the decisions that were made in the following of that. And so that created this opportunity. And then Democrats to admit that once that was done, the administration hasn't fixed what was broken. They right. allowed it to still be broken in the course of this. And fundamentally, I don't see a strategy that has been laid out that actually says, how can we really deal with this? As you know, I had a son, did two tours in Iraq, so I'm very familiar with what it does to a family and what it does to sort of say this whole quote, which I agree with, actually, Martin O'Reilly, because I boots on the ground, I can't stand that term because it acts as like they're not even human beings.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And there's, you know, it's obviously our most precious resource, which is the blood of men and women in this country that serve. And I think that if the idea that we're going to send ground troops into Syria or somewhere and somehow deal with this and turn around and think we're going to turn this around in a year, 2 years, 3 years, it's a generational, this is a generation ahead of us of how to deal with this. I don't have an answer other than that we're going to have to figure out a way to force other Middle Eastern countries to actually deal with the problem that's in their backyard. The idea that Saudi Arabia, in my view, is one, hasn't accepted a single refugee, seems to be part of the process of how people become radicalized and what's going on in Saudi Arabia. And three, doesn't seem to be a real ally in anything that we're trying to do other than it's in their interest. And until we sort of force the hand of Arab countries that are surrounding it to actually deal with a problem in their backyard, I don't see how we can deal with it in an ocean way.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, as you're talking about this, and I was reading the polls, I don't think people, for the most part, are anxious for us to send our troops anywhere. I think what people are most looking for is what's the plan? What are we going to do? I think that's part of the uncertainty that has led people to want more assurances on the other subject, which is the refugees. And we're just sort of...
I agree with you, but I also think part of the thing is I think this administration is out of juice to be able to convince the public of anything about that.
Yeah.
I think that this time is up. Time has run out on this administration, on the American public's willing to accept what they say and what they want to do.
Yeah.
Unless they did a complete wholesale change, what they seem unwilling to do. And I think that we are in a process of a holding pattern until hopefully we get a president that can unite the country on a strategy. And I'm hopeful, but not, I'm not banking on that will emerge in the short run. But I think this presidency it's almost impossible for President Obama to be able to do that at this point.
I completely agree with you. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me on Off-Road Politics. Folks, you can follow Matt on Twitter. It's at MATTHEWJDowd. You can read his columns on the ABC News website, and you can watch his brilliance on Sunday morning on This Week. You can also see him on Good Morning America, ABC News, and Nightline. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be with you, Selena. Always good to talk to you.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Happy Thanksgiving.
Okay. Bye-bye.